dying, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
Back again. Welcome, everyone. This is Red Ice Radio, and I'm Henrik Palmgren. That is Swedish, by the way. And we're glad to have you with us wherever you are joining us from. We are, of course, accessible worldwide wherever there is internet connection. I hope you're having a good day and that you'll enjoy spending some of your time with us today as we continue to investigate the mysteries, the cover-ups, and the hidden history of the world. We do so by not only utilizing our busy news section on redicecreations.com, we also invite to our radio program various researchers from all kinds of different backgrounds to talk about the bigger picture and the details of all the different topics that we consider to be interesting and also important. Today we're talking with a professional designer, builder, student of sacred geometry, and longtime Freemason, Randall Carlson, about the inception of the Gothic cathedrals, architecture, the aspiration for a connection to a higher force, God, if you will, through the language of sacred geometry. Randall is uniquely qualified to interpret the hidden meaning of the greater masterpieces of mystical architecture. It is his aspiration to effect a revival of lost knowledge towards the goal of creating the new world based upon universal principles of harmony, freedom, and spiritual evolution. Carlson, in his work, emphasizes the cyclical nature of time and the periodic catastrophes responsible for the collective amnesia of our species. Stay tuned as we will get into some very interesting aspects of the power of architecture and the placement of the Gothic cathedrals on Earth energy node points. All right, welcome back, Randall. Good to talk to you once again. How have you been since we last talked?
Well, mostly good, you know.
Yeah.
Life throws you some curveballs sometimes, but hey, I'm still here. I had a pulse this morning when I woke up, so that was a good sign.
Same here. It's not always easy going days, but it's good to talk to you again nonetheless. And this is a fun topic. Last time we had you with us, of course, we talked about cycles of catastrophe. We spent 3 great hours with you. And I urge anyone, of course, that is new to this program or haven't heard about you before, Randall, to go back into our archives and check out that interview, because that's really a subject that dovetails where we're going to go today, which is, of course, into the cosmic patterns part of the work that you guys are doing, and of course tying in sacred geometry into this as well. Tell us first of all, Randall, how long have you been interested in numbers, symbolism, geometry, geodesy, etc.?
Well, I got into it in the early 70s. I used to belong to a meditation group, and we had an architect in that group that was very inspired by the work of Buckminster Fuller. And we did a retreat in the summer of 1972 up in the woods of northern Minnesota. And he designed a dome, a geodesic-type dome, that was kind of extrapolated from the work of Buckminster Fuller along with some of the Islamic architectural design motifs that he had been studying. And I was one of the few people in the group that had carpentry and building experience. having my father having been a carpenter builder. So I got it drafted to sort of be the lead carpenter on it. And it was very interesting. And it led me into the work of Buckminster Fuller. And it led me into some of the extraordinary geometry involved in the building of Islamic mosques. So that was about, if I had a point of beginning on this thing, I would put it that summer of 1972, because after that I got very interested in the subject. There was a publication that came out called Shelter, kind of an oversized magazine format, and they featured this dome that we built in that particular book. And they had a lot of other stuff in there about vernacular architecture from around the world and the various systems that different cultures and societies had employed to build their infrastructure. And it was in that work that I first encountered the golden section, ideas of harmony in building and how geometry related to building, references to medieval Freemasonry and so on. So that period between 1972 and 1973 was sort of, for me, the period of inception or germination for all of these interests. And then they sort of accelerated through the 70s, and I put my first class together in 1980. So I've been doing classes and seminars and workshops now, I guess, for, you know, over three decades.
It's funny, Randall, that so much seems to go back to Buckminster Fuller. I hear so many people talking about old Bucky and the stuff he did, and he seems to be a real pull and a real draw. He was kind of a genius, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. If you can, you know, he invented his own language, because the language to express the concepts he was working with didn't exist. So he invented his own languages and his own terminology. So if you attempt to read some of his work, like the two volume Synergetics, it's a challenge. You know, you've got to learn his particular vernacular. But yeah, he was a big influence on things, you know, coming a lot of these interests and studies and opening to these new ideas, you know, of course, came out of the 1960s. They had their predecessor researchers and teachers and so forth that go back. And we can talk about a little bit of the history of that. But, you know, they were way out on the fringe, and not too many people knew about them. You know, the work of George Lesser or Jay Hambidge, some of the early pioneers in trying to recover some of this information. But really seems in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, when there was so much intellectual and spiritual ferment in going on, a lot of people started looking into these things. You know, a lot of us in the West, you know, a lot of young people were connected with spiritual ideas that came out of the East and so on. And like I mentioned, the reference to Islamic architecture, you know, and of course there was, you know, the various spiritual traditions from Hinduism and Buddhism and so forth that also recognized this sacred component of geometry and the employment of, you know, in Hindu philosophy, you have the idea of karma and right work, which means that we're trying to, you know, through our work and through the things that we create in this world, we're trying to, you know, spread the ideas of harmony and so on. So, you know, a lot of us were influenced by those ideas. I kind of gravitated back more towards the Western tradition and got very interested in Western spiritual traditions, which, you know, led me into the study of Mithraism and Gnosticism and Catharism and many of these things. And when you start getting into these, you start doing this, you know, interdisciplinary studies of these things, you realize that there are common threads that run throughout it. And that's what got me interested, was what are the commonalities between the religious beliefs and what are the common threads that unite the various spiritual beliefs? And being, you know, thoroughly, you know, raised in the Western milieu in America, I was very interested in how do we translate these ideas into our day-to-day life? And how do we create a world that can express, you know, a higher spiritual philosophy, as we certainly see precedents for throughout, you know, many cultures,
right,
which is, you know, something we can talk about as we go.
Well, it's a good point. It seems the more we go back in the ancient world, there was a different reverence for the buildings that was made at that point, to temples. And of course, these were places where you people went to connect with God in many cases as well. But just overall, there seems to be a reverence for beauty and to bring these ratios into the environment of the human world. Something we seem to have lost today when you look around at most of the architecture, which is completely opposite. It's like you can feel sick just walking into certain buildings or looking at them. You know, so we've lost something there, right?
Oh, I definitely believe so. And when you look at the historical trend, what's interesting, the last great flowering of, a spiritual worldview that manifested in the built infrastructure of society was the Gothic period, with the great cathedrals. And when you you've probably traveled around Europe and when you've been into cathedrals, you can go to just one cathedral, Amiens or Chartres. And you look at it and you realize, here was a work that took well over a century, maybe in some cases two centuries or longer. You realize that a lot of times the people that began the work on these things knew that they weren't even going to be alive to see the finish of it.
I know.
You had maybe sometimes multiple generations of the same family working on one building. And also when you look at the the wealth of society in those days, you realize that, in the context of those days, it took like almost the whole society oriented around this project of building these magnificent cathedrals, literally that would have taken hundreds of thousands of workers and craftspeople and, geometricians, astronomers, masons and carpenters and glaziers, and the list goes on and on. And then, of course, the infrastructure to support this tremendous workforce. It is as if the whole society, something inspired these people to this great work, and we really don't know what that was. So we find that repeated, as we go back through history. Of course, what I was taught as a kid was, the slaves built the Egyptian pyramids and so on. Yeah. But of course, that idea, I think, has been thoroughly discredited. And I think it's another example of, this inspiration that seems to seize a hold of people that inspires them to, to these extraordinary efforts. And like you said, that seems to be missing these days. We've become very materialistic and yeah, go ahead.
What I wanted to say is just to reemphasize a point that you brought up, which is a really good one. Still to this day, these cathedrals are the pull in many cities around Europe. We were down and looked at the Charlemagne Cathedral in Aachen in Germany, and we also been to Strasbourg's cathedral. And these are, they're powerful buildings. They emanate something, and when you look up at them, you see all these people are standing around looking at awe at these buildings, like, wow, what is it? And this is like almost now 1,000 years ago in some cases. And there's still the pull. And there's very few things that we've done, mankind, consequently, that kind of, adds up to what they did then. Why is that, do you think? Well, I mean, there's some architectural wonders around the world, modern building and so forth. But overall, I mean, these old buildings are still the pull, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, that to me is the mystery. There was that spiritual impetus that drove these people to do this. You do see that, that there are trends in society, and once something gets underway, many people kind of get on board with it, and then there's a waxing and waning. Of course, going back again to the 60s, I remember the excitement around the space program, and in recent times, that's the only thing that I can think of that actually comes close to paralleling this, where, at least in America, I remember well as in my growing up years, how exciting it was for me as an adolescent and as a teenager to follow the space program. And it was really a big deal in this country. And for about a decade, that was something that really got people fired up. I don't know what happened. Of course, then the interest in that sort of waned, as we got into the 70s, when the Vietnam War sort of took over people's consciousness. And that was, a big objective of the late 60s and early 70s was trying to bring that war to an end. And,
yeah.
Somehow, you know, by the time the mid-70s came along, the interest and the fervor had died down. You know, if you go back and, you know, you look at the prospectus that was laid out in the late 60s and early 70s, we were going to basically be launching our first manned expedition to Mars within the 1980s and have permanent colonies on the moon. You know, and if you look at some of the things, you know, free-floating colonies in space, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Gerard O'Neill and his students out of Princeton in the mid-70s. They came up with concepts for building this, you know, these great revolving cities in space.
Right, yeah.
You know, there was a lot of interest in that, and then it just sort of dissipated, and I'm not sure why. But I've often thought in retrospect, you know, if we had pursued that, that would have been in a sense comparable, because it would have required this massive support of a lot of people in society. You know, when I looked at something that's very interesting that I do in some of my slideshows and so forth, is that I show the aerodynamic geometry of our rocket ships and the hull of like the fuel tank of the space shuttle and so on. And it's precisely the geometry of the Gothic vault.
Really?
Which is, huh. Yeah, it is. And when you see them overlaid, it's quite extraordinary. And I kind of think in a way that's sort of, it's more than just a coincidence, because in a way, you know, a rocket ship or, you know, the space shuttle is about the physical transportation of human consciousness and human life forms out into space physically. Yeah. The Gothic Cathedral is about the launching of the human spirit, the human soul into space, you see? So there's this parallel there. And the fact that you see the same geometry manifested in the Gothic vault that you do the space shuttle, to me was quite an extraordinary revelation when I first realized that they had designed a vault that manifested perfect aerodynamic geometry. If, you know, you were going to translate that to a vehicle for launching payloads into space.
Uh-huh. So is there a relationship in your view between geometry and God then, or the search for that, like a religious connection to it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, didn't all of the, the great spiritual teachers and so forth have always saw that. I mean, you know, going back to the theologian, St. Augustine said, numbers are the thoughts of God. Galileo said, mathematics is the alphabet with which God has written the universe. Kepler said, geometry existed before the creation. It is co-eternal with the mind of God. Geometry provided God with a model for the creation. So I think we find that idea infused not only, you know, in spiritual traditions, but really like the early scientists. I mean, all of these guys from Galileo to Kepler to Newton, they were all motivated by this spiritual impulse. You know, I mean, I think it's pretty well known now that Newton was an ardent alchemist and, you know, searching for the philosopher's stone in his work. So that idea was still prevalent. In getting back to the history of the thing, you notice like during the days of operative Freemasonry, which was the 12th and 13th centuries when these Gothic cathedrals were being built, if you look around the world, you find that there were parallel enterprises going on. The last great wave of architectural enterprise took place in Indonesia and Southeast Asia during those same centuries. We look at the last wave of monumental earthwork building in North America before it died out, took place during those same two centuries. You know, this Mesoamerican, pre-Columbian Mesoamerican architecture that we find in the Yucatan and in Mexico and Guatemala, same thing. The last, it was almost like the last impetus, the last upsurge of this activity took place simultaneously around the world, essentially during that period from the 11th to 13th centuries.
Yeah.
And you've got to wonder, you know, how is that? Why is that? Why were these people sort of almost simultaneously motivated? It's almost as if like the whistle went off and then everybody said, time to get to work. And then everybody went to work, and then come around the early 13th century, it sort of just began to decline. And I think there's a number of factors in that. I mean, social factors, but also natural factors, because if you look at the history of climate, not to digress too much in that, but it does play a role in this, you know, coming out of the Dark Ages essentially lasted from the early 6th century into about the mid 10th century. And this was extremely hard times for societies in Europe. Then about 950 to 1050 AD, you had this warming of the climate, by not much, but it was a significant warming, what's been known as the medieval warm period. And then what that did was stimulated a period of exceptional growth, social advancement in European society. For one thing, what it did was it expanded the agricultural belt 300 to 400 miles further north. It extended the growing season by 4 to 6 weeks, and also elevated altitude at which crops could be grown. And all of this led to food surpluses, which then led to people being much more well-nourished, which led to longer lifespans, and generally increased the wealth of society after the 300 to 400 years of Dark Ages. Well, after about a century and a half of this, society had gotten wealthy enough that it could undertake such an ambitious program as the building of the cathedrals. Without that shift in climate and the agricultural surpluses that came in its wake, even if there was this impetus from somewhere to do this, to undertake this work, the means would have not been available. So it was at the point where society now had the means and the capability and the wealth to undertake such a project, suddenly it was almost as if, okay, here's the blueprints, get to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's something here where for a new project to begin, if you will, or a new mankind launching into a new area, let's say, there seems to be either there have to be an incentive from the point of view that things are really, really bad, or there has to be something that really enables that. In this case, you're talking about surplus. There was more abundance in energy, really, which is food. Yes. And everything else at the end of it. But and today we're kind of in the same situation, almost same quagmire. We're consuming more and more energy. There are inventors out there. They're looking into alternatives. And maybe something like that, if that would come along, if there's a discovery that would lead to, if you will, then quote unquote surplus in energy, maybe a new leap forward would actually begin. What do you think?
Well, in my more optimistic moments, which are tend to be the prevalent ones, that's what I believe is going to happen.
Right.
I kind of really think societies globally, I mean, what we of course see is an emergence of a global society. And what we see is, I think we're faced with kind of a bifurcation in the road here. There's two different ways we can go. We can, you know, go towards a command and control society where it's a hierarchical authoritarian society from the top down. I hope we don't go that direction. I would much rather see us become liberated and see people become free in their ability to create, to build, to express. And then I at this point, I think that there's basically no limits to what we could accomplish in the next decades or century or two if we start taking the long view. But it's just, it's a matter of what's going on in our consciousness.
Right, exactly. And it's also funny at the same time, because you can flip everything, because understandably there is many that also see associated with the rise of the Gothic period another kind of wickedness, tied to a tyrannical rule where everyone was subjugated to the church, if you know what I mean. So although that there's a fruits of the architectural feats that were taken at the time, there's also a kind of an enslavement, if you will, that follows on from that, which is very unfortunate, of course. So I hope that in this case, both and can lead to a positive growth cycle, if you know what I mean.
Yes. And you know, it's interesting when you bring that up, because, yes, absolutely, there was this entrenched authoritarian church at the time. But you also see that there was this other element that seemed to actually utilize working through the church almost without their awareness, because, you know, when you begin to go to looking into cathedrals and so forth, I mean, they're filled with things that could only be construed as pagan.
Well, that's true.
You know, it's there. I mean, it's, and then of course you had the various groups that I think had a lot of influence in it. I think clearly that the Templar Knights were involved in the whole thing. They were probably the ones who handled the finances, if not involved in some of the engineering itself. And it's interesting that, you know, with the, you see the Gothic, like inception of Notre Dame Cathedral began in, 1130, a mere 2 years after the return of the original nine Templar Knights from the Holy Land. And, you know, we're not sure what they actually uncovered during their decade-long sojourn there, but it is known that they apparently undertook what could be considered the first archaeological excavation, which was, you know, going into the abandoned ruins of Solomon's Temple. And whatever they returned with, you know, may have been documents, may have been, you know, some kind of information, scientific information they brought back, because they returned to France in 1128. And then in 2 years, the, you know, the construction began on the first of the high Gothic cathedrals.
They start up basically right after that. Get to work, everybody, because we have a job to do. And what is that? What was that, do you think?
Well, it, you know, when you begin to look at the whole phenomena, there's so many elements to it. And, it, you know, it gets, it's very complex. I mean, clearly one of the things that they did was they, you know, they went to sites that, you know, the placement of the cathedrals was not at random. They didn't go in and say, nah, this looks like a good spot. I mean, these places had been recognized to have special properties. You know, they had been places of pilgrimage, places of great sanctity long before the cathedrals were built.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you begin to see these elements there that, that seem to be common to them all. Chartres Cathedral, for example, is built on a mound that was originally a site of pagan pilgrimage. And it had a well there that was, you know, a sacred well. And what's interesting is that, and I think it was either Louis Charpentier, I think, that pointed this out, that if you go in, you can actually still see the well if you go down into the crypt below the cathedral.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Which and the depth of the water table, of course, it fluctuates somewhat, but overall the depth of the water table below the paving stones of the nave, it's the same distance from the paving stones down to the water table, which is the same as the height of the vault. Now that could be coincidence, but various, I think Guy Underwood in his book Pattern of the Past also confirmed that in all the cathedrals he studied, there seemed to be a geological component. They all seemed to be built over the confluence of underground water courses.
That's right.
And that, you know, that brings up some very interesting possibilities. You've probably had guests, or you are yourself somewhat familiar with the work of Wilhelm Reich.
Sure, yeah.
And his work with life energy and his experimentation with various devices that were designed to concentrate the life energy, which he called orgone. And if you look at his, you know, his, some of his technologies, like the orgone accumulator, he, you know, used a system of layering that was alternating organic and inorganic. You're probably somewhat familiar with that. I'm sure at some point you've had somebody on your program talking about that.
We briefly talked about that. Yeah, go ahead, Randall.
You know, one of the things that he discovered was that there seemed to be a great affinity between water and the bioenergy, the orgone force, particularly if the water was moving. And, you know, there that also seemed to be confirming some of the work of Victor Schauberger, who seemed to develop ideas of water moving, particularly in spiral patterns, manifesting energy properties. And, you know, a lot of dowsers, you know, I've seen some exceptional dowsers at work. You know, I had friends that were actually in the Marines in Vietnam that in their companies, they would have a dowser looking for to locate landmines. In my building work, I've seen, you know, institutions like the phone company here who actually use dowsers to investigate the properties of a site before they excavated. So, and I've had enough experience with it myself to be convinced that there is something, some sort of a subtle energy at work there. You know, and it, going back to Wilhelm Reich, he discovered that, you know, with his, he called them the Cloudbuster devices, and he discovered that they didn't work unless he grounded them into flowing water. And it was almost as if he used the Cloudbuster device to close some kind of a circuit of subtle energy between the Earth and the atmosphere. And in a sense, when you look at a Cloudbuster and how it works, you know, I'm reminded very much of the spires of the Gothic cathedrals and they're them being placed over underground water, which seems to be one of the consistent factors that you see in their design over and over again. When coming over here to North America, you know, prior, I mentioned earlier the reference to monumental earthwork architecture. Well, when you invariably, when you look at the siting and location of the great earth mounds and truncated pyramids and so forth that were built out of earth, you see two things that reminds you one of Reichian technologies. One is that they're always sited next to water, usually flowing water, oftentimes at the confluence of streams or rivers, or there's a complex of mounds, and right at the center of the complex, there's a spring that emerges, again suggesting that there's a confluence of probably fault lines or fissures in the bedrock over which these mounds are built. And the other thing is that in the structuring of the mounds, they're not just heaped up piles of earth, but they're very carefully layered. And what you'll see is alternating layers, for example, of clay, which is predominantly mineral, along with organic soils. And they will build these things up in multiple layers. Sometimes half a dozen or 10 or 12 layers will compose an entire mound structure. So again, this was very systematic. They didn't just dig up earth and put it up in a big pile. They brought in earth from various places and then arranged it in this layered fashion, which of course, to me, is very remindful of the function of one of Reich's orgone accumulators. So, you know, I think we're just like on the verge of you know, rediscovering basically what I think of as lost technologies.
Well, Randall, I mean, that's tremendously interesting, that point you bring up. And we know from ancient Egyptian knowledge, of course, that the interaction with stone is also a tremendous, you know, active component to this. The stone seems to have accumulative properties, if you will, and certain stones works in a different way. And it's also about the amount of stones used. So if we go back to the Gothic cathedrals, these, you know, monumental stone accumulators or whatever they actually are then can have two potential functions. One is to tap, if you will, the natural energy flow of the earth in some way, and either utilizing that for a good purpose, or it's actually to kind of effectively put a lid on it to kind of dampen the natural grid that is beneficial to the flow of the energy. What do you think that they're there for?
Well, you know, I'm reminded of the alchemical dictum that as it is above, so it is below. And you know, in a way, the building of these sacred structures is a very physical manifestation of that idea. On the one hand, you know, if you know, we mentioned the astronomical component, you know, they all have this orientation. So when you look at you begin to look at the criteria, you find that siting is important. It's not random. There seems to be geological considerations and energetic or properties of a certain site. But then there's also the astronomical element that's probably even recognized even earlier than the geological component. Mm-hmm. And that is that they're oriented to the sky. The axes of these structures will oftentimes align themselves with the rising and setting lines of the sun and the moon and key astronomical bodies, various stars, Sirius, the Pleiades, and so on. And also they seem to mimic patterns, like the Notre Dame cathedrals create a very close mimicking of the, if you actually look at a map, they create a sort of a representation of the stars of Virgo, which, you know, you got to wonder how that came about. You know, it's not exact, but it's very close. I mean, it's remarkably close when you overlay a map of the stars of Virgo on top of the Notre Dame cathedrals, mm-hmm. which, you know, seems to be consistent because the Notre Dame cathedrals, of course, are dedicated to the Virgin. Right. And so, You go, well, you know, how did this come about? Well, did they deliberately try to survey over vast distances, you know, literally covering thousands of square miles and attempt to lay out the positions of these structures to mimic the patterns of the star field? But then on the other hand, you go, well, let's see. There was pre-existing conditions there. For example, the presence of water. And the if you reference the work of his name skips my mind right now, the Dragon Project, who did a lot of geological work throughout the British Isles, Paul Devereux, discovering along with the work of Guy Underwood and a few others, who discovered that there was this important geological connection to the sighting. And, you know, in his book Pattern of the Past, Guy Underwood documents how so many of these various sacred structures are positioned right over where the fault lines converge, which are often the positions where the underground water emerges from its subterranean realm out into the light of day. Well, okay, so now we've got this situation where, on the one hand, there's this astronomical component that seems to play a role in the sighting. But then on the other hand, you've got the geological component. And you go, let me see, if there are these, the pattern of fracture lines within the lithosphere leads to the sighting of these structures at these certain positions. And then they turn around and reflect the stars above. What's going on here? we seem to have this reflection almost in the rock below our feet and the stars over our head.
It's about aligning the top with the middle, with the ground, if you will. It's an alignment, right?
It's an alignment. That's exactly what it is. And you know, when you look at it, and you know, the roots of these cathedrals and many of these structures go deep into the bedrock. You essentially are creating a resonant chamber over this location, where there may be unique energy properties that someone who has the sensitivity or the instruments to detect. And then on the other hand, you have these spires going up almost like antenna, again, bringing to my mind some kind of advanced, very sophisticated Reichian related technology that, you know, which essentially has been lost. And the fact that we're sitting here talking about it as we are now, suggests that there's enough interest in it that maybe we're on the verge of rediscovering something really profound about our own history that's been overlooked within conventional interpretations.
Very interesting. I'm thinking about the idea of anchoring heaven on earth, or as it says in the Bible, your kingdom come, you will be, your will be done on the earth as it is in heaven, right? That this is a communication with God and an agreement, more or less, right? That mankind is trying to replicate what is in heaven on earth, correct?
Yes. And in a lot of the Gnostic texts, I believe it's the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus is quoted as saying, "Is the kingdom is all about you, but you don't see it. It's spread over the whole face of the earth, but you don't see it."
Fascinating, fascinating. Now, is this a in the presentation? Of course, the DVD, and I rewatched that again. Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe. Great presentation, by the way. And you bring up the idea of the first language. You talk about the confusion of lip. That the story in the Bible is that there was a breakup there. But this reference that the first language was a universal language of symbolism and geometry, basically. Is this the same language, what we're talking about right now, with the architectural ratios and all that?
Yes, I would think so. You know, I would think that, you know, we're looking at, you know, a recovery of this information. But, you know, we're in such a unique position now, because, you know, we can go back and we can look at geometry being utilized by the Gothic builders. We can look at Egyptian geometry. We can look at Greek geometry. And, you know, to some extent, I'm sure that, you know, there was cross-pollination going on. But, you know, we now have access to so much knowledge and information. You know, we're recovering. You know, of course, you know, it's difficult to discern how the Gothic builders may have known or not about what pre-Columbian Mesoamerican builders were doing in Central America. But, you know, underlying the outer forms of these temples, what we find are the same geometric patterns, the same templates are being used. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the same units of measurement are being used. Now, how that comes about, whether, you know, the development of metrology, then the way things we measure space, if we look at the earth mounds, for example, I've documented extensively how many of the measurements based that were derived from the early surveys of the earth mounds appear to be Sumerian in origin.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be difficult to describe how all that would work, you know, just over the radio because it's a very visual thing. But one of the things that I developed was a pattern, a metrological unifying pattern, which it's based on the root ratios of the square root of 2, the square root of 3, the phi ratio or phi ratio, the square root of 5, that synthesizes this unique dynamic geometry. And from that, we can derive several dozen ancient units of measurement, from the Egyptian royal cubit to the Riemann to the Palestinian cubit to the Roman cubit to the megalithic yard to our modern yard. And, you know, it's difficult to describe. It actually, when you see it, the pattern itself, it begins to appear that there is a common geometry that unites all of these ancient systems of measurement that were used to build the sacred structures. So that's even another component. When you begin to look at the sighting considerations and the orientation to cosmic events, the possibility of a common metrological system, you have to begin to wonder, are we looking at just some kind of an individualized expression that each of these groups of people were subject to, or was there a literal connection that occurred? There's here where I live in Georgia, the Cherokee were very prevalent. And when you look into the Cherokee legends, they have some interesting things. There's they have a legend about what they called them the Nunahai. And they were the people who could travel anywhere. And I often think the Nunahai, and then there's the Anunnaki of the Sumerians. There was the Anasazi of the Chacoan people. A number of others, where phonetically there seems to be a root that's the same throughout,
yeah.
Which raises to me the possibility that, was there a group whose identity has essentially been lost to history that somehow had some information, some knowledge at their disposal that allowed them to not only inspire these various cultural groups to undertaking these great enterprises, but also the technical means to do so.
Yeah.
That to me is a very interesting question. And I think it's one that we shouldn't be too ready to dismiss that possibility that there was somebody, some group. And then of course, when we look at the various, like for example, the Freemasons, they have traditions about almost that exact thing. I mean, after all, the traveling Freemasons. I mean, all Freemasons to this day refer to themselves as, traveling men,
mm-hmm.
that they travel, Well, maybe that's hearkening back to this tradition. When we go back to the building of the Gothic, we had operative Freemasonry. Then with the decline of the Gothic, and going back to this, the thing you brought up earlier about the authoritarianism of the church, this great upsurge of activity declined in the early 14th century. And almost within a decade after the suppression of the Templars, we see so many of these cathedrals that were never quite finished. We'd almost as if they laid down their tools. Suddenly the means and the resources begin to fade away. And this comes right on the heel of the suppression of the Templar order between 1310 and 1314.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we also see a shift in climate. Again, to bring that aspect of it back, that period also saw the ending of the medieval warm period and the onset of the Little Ice Age. And, you know, that brought about a cooling. And there was a period there, I believe around 1350, right about the mid-14th century, where there was multiple years in a row that saw agricultural collapses. And this, again, of course, produced starvation and famine, which then led to the onset of the plague, which wiped out a third of the European population. And so at that point, you know, suddenly people were just concerned with surviving, and we don't really see much going on in the way of cathedral building.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned operative Freemasonry. You're a Freemason as well, by the way. And so when speculative Masonry comes onto the scene, what do you think happens at that point? Was it was some of this knowledge lost? Was it I don't know, hijacked? I mean, is there still any of this knowledge left in the lodges anymore?
I believe so. And in fact, I think that speculative Masonry or philosophical Masonry came about, evolved simply as a means whereby much of this knowledge could be preserved. Mm-hmm. Because as the operative aspect of the craft began to decline, I think the masters of the craft realized, well, we need a way to preserve this information, and so they began to open their ranks to non-builders, to folks that weren't actually utilizing who weren't actually laying stone upon stone, who weren't actually engaged in the, you know, the design and erection of these structures. And what you see is that over the next 300 or 400 years, a shift from the operational aspect of the craft to the speculative or philosophical. Mm. And you still see evidence. I mean, there is evidence in Italy. Louis Charpentier, in his book, The Mysteries of Chartres Cathedral Documents, talks about the Compagnons, which were the successors to the operative Masons, and still actually engaged in building activity right up until the dawn of the 20th century. As we come into the 20th century, we pretty much see it's like the impetus has finally died out. Here in Atlanta, there are two buildings that apparently bear the imprint of operative Masonry. One is the well-known Fox Theater, and then there's another building that actually, if you go in there and you know what to look for, you know, because the Fox Theater, I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, it was actually built as a Masonic temple originally. Yeah.
And then, well, is it still the same in the L.A., like Kodak Theater, same thing there, right?
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, well, there's a famous Masons hall. I think it's the Kodak Theater anyway, and it was been turned into later something else. But we see an echo there, similar fate, if you will, of the building then.
An echo, that's a good way to put it. And then as we come into the 20th century, it's almost as if this impetus reaches its absolute nadir, and then you see the first signs of a revival. You see in the early 20th century, like the work of Jay Hambidge is a good example, who began to recover some of the dynamic geometry that was utilized in these design of the temples. And he developed a whole system he called a dynamic symmetry, and it was based upon the same root ratios I mentioned earlier in regards to this unifying metrological pattern. I think his work came about in the 1920s. and there was the work of Bly Bond, who did the excavations. He was the ecclesiastical architect who did the excavations at Glastonbury Abbey.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so there was a number of these things that sort of began to precipitate this revival that began to pick up momentum as the decades rolled on, and then I think just got a full head of steam in the late 60s and early 70s with so many revelations. I mean, the work of Keith Critchlow and John Michel and many of these others that I had mentioned earlier. And now we're, you know, in this, you know, the fact that we're having this dialogue, and presumably thousands of people will be listening to it and reading these books and thinking about these things. I mean, this is to me what is you know, stimulating. What could be, you know, we would cross a threshold where suddenly enough people are going, wait a second, there's something more to this. You know, there was something in our heritage that we've forgotten, and it's time to remember what it was and maybe put it to work. Because if we don't, we're going to have our future is going to be pretty tough. If we don't begin to understand the principles of harmony, which seems to be at the core of what this was all about. If we don't begin to understand how in our own past, you know, peoples were able to work together, you know, in Freemasonry, one of the great allegories is the building of King Solomon's temple, which of course was this, collusion, if you will, between the ancient Hebrews and the Tyrians, or the, you know, King, there was King Hiram of Tyre, who was of course a pagan. And then there was King Solomon. And basically the tradition that led into modern Islam and the tradition that led into modern Judaism basically worked together to build King Solomon's temple. King Solomon provided the template and the plan, and King Hiram of Tyre provided basically the labor force and most of the materials. And so by this collaborative effort, they were able to create this great symbolical edifice that lies at the core of all Masonic symbolism today.
Now, okay, so the question is it lost? Is it continuing? As when we begin to look at, for example, of the city planning of Washington, D.C., right? Okay, granted, this is some time ago now, but nonetheless, Pierre L'Enfant, or whatever his name was, you know, incorporates this into it. There's other people involved in that, and it still seems to continue. We have things like the Hoover Dam. Gordon Kaufman, the architect, builds star maps into you know, the building, and there's although it's a functional temple for engineering purposes, it's still like a spiritual temple as well on top of it. So is there not a continuation of it going on to this day?
Oh, I think so. You know, I've been out to Hoover Dam specifically looking for that, you know, and often as you come there to Hoover Dam, there's a, well, most people just miss it. There's a pull off where you do, and there's about a half acre with this huge statue of this angelic presence, this dominating angelic presence. And down inscribed into the stone is a model of the Great Year.
Yeah.
I photographed it, but this was in the transition. We had just gone to, they had just changed the security at the airports,
the scanners and everything.
The scanner, yeah. They had just changed the technology of the scanner, and when I came back from there,
they ruined your camera.
It ruined my fit. Yeah. So I'm going to have to make a trip back out there. But yeah, I mean, it was all inscribed there. Just this whole astronomical depiction of the Great Year phenomena.
That's why you opt out, people, by the way. No, go ahead.
That's why you what?
That's why you opt out and go for the pat down instead of the scan.
But go ahead. Exactly. But so there it is. You know, I was quite surprised when I saw it. Mm-hmm. I'm going, wow, this is, here it is right in front of us.
Yep.
I mean, and you know, having been a Freemason now for, since 1978, actually, I realize that most Masons today don't really understand this stuff. But it's almost like, you know, you take somebody into a library and here's all of these books with all of this information in it, but nobody's really taking the books off and opening them and reading what's in it. When you go into the Masonic system, what you realize is you're handed this treasure box that's full of symbolism. And in fact, even as you go through the degrees, you're encouraged. Well, if you want to understand the symbols, you've got to study geometry. You've got to study music. You've got to study astronomy. And, you know, it's regrettable that, you know, very few Masons actually take that to heart and undertake studies of those subjects in order to try to decipher the meaning of this symbolism. But it's there. I mean, there is just extraordinary wealth of symbolical, there's a whole symbolical tradition that the modern Freemasons are custodians of.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying in a way that many don't make it their calling, if you will, that they are focusing on other things and not the knowledge that is preserved therein.
Exactly. But you know, you got to say that Freemasonry is a sort of a multidimensional thing. You know, it does tremendous charitable work, and you have Masons who come in and spend many, many hours of their spare time raising money for the Masonic charities. You know, Masons, they endow orphanages, they build hospitals for crippled children. They build hospitals for most of their charity goes towards the care of children. They build eye hospitals. The list goes on and on. Every year, Masons raise millions of dollars for charity. And you have Masons that come in and they're not intellectually inclined to like study into these things, but they spend many, many hours raising money and doing charitable work. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. You've also got brothers who will come in who are excellent ritualists. They don't necessarily know what the ritual means. It's almost as if, you know, because what Freemasonry is essentially is an encoded mystery drama in which all of this that serves as a repository for all of this symbolism. So, you know, if a brother comes in and masters the ritual and then preserves it and then teaches it to a young apprentice that comes in, and then that apprentice masters the ritual and teaches it to another generation, they are also serving an important function by preserving this tradition of symbolism and knowledge, so that those who are inclined to look into the deeper meanings and make the connections, the historical and scientific connections and so on, it's there. It's intact. It's there so that those few who are motivated to do so will have the material available to them to do it. So, you know, it's not required that all the Masons who go in understand the underlying astronomy or the underlying geometry. What's important is that they preserve that, or that they fulfill that custodial function. And Freemasons often refer to themselves as, you know, custodians of this tradition.
You know, I always like to refer to a program we did with Christopher Knight. He's also a Freemason a while back, and he's done research for many, many years. He's also looked into many alternatives when it comes to construction of buildings. He's studying something called the megalithic yard and the 366 yeah. degree circle and all that. And he's basically found that the whole Pentagon building is actually a replica of Stonehenge in England, pretty much. I don't know if you heard about this. But on top of that also, he's also come to the conclusion that on the upper levels, the 32nd, the 33rd degree, it's a completely different deal, apparently, than what it is for the rest of the Masonic Brotherhood, and that he is he's found that there's stuff going on up there that the others are not at all aware of, if you know what I mean. Have you found any similarities to that?
Well, you know, I've gone through the 32nd degree. You know, there are not that many 33rd degree Masons. I've read a couple of his books, but mm-hmm. I don't think I've read his latest one where he talks about that. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, please do. And let me know what you think.
When I was master of my lodge in 1990, and the Grand Master of Masons in Georgia, William Hutchinson, who's since deceased, he was an elderly gentleman. He and I were pretty good friends. He was a 33rd degree Mason, and you know, we had some pretty extensive conversations and so forth. I never got the impression from him that there was anything really profoundly different going on in the 33rd degree. That doesn't mean that wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe someday. See, all of the degrees up through the 32nd degree, which is the Scottish Rite, are volitional. You go of your own free will and do it. And in fact, you have to actually proactively seek the degrees.
But
the
you 33rd, can't. Yeah, exactly. You can't do the 33. Yeah. So go ahead.
It's conferred. It's an honorary degree that's conferred, usually in recognition of an outstanding, you know, Masonic service over many years. But at this point, you know, whether there's something going on there or not, you know, probably, but I can't say what it is. Because I don't know.
The thing with Christopher Knight talked about anyway was the idea that the building of the Pentagon, the preparation for the Second World War, was done at a haste and at a very disciplined manner, according to whoever was actually in charge of commissioning it at the time. I forget his name right now. It was one of the president, pretty much, I think, and I forget which one. And some of the presidents were, of course, rushed into the 33rd degree as well. They were made honorary, you know, members of this very, very quickly. But nonetheless, the quirk there that we were trying to get to, and that Christopher really pondered upon when we talked with him about this, was that there was a almost like a pre existing knowledge that the Second World War was going to come about. I can send you the interview that we did with Christopher Knight, Randall, and you listen to it and see what you think about it. But it was a very contemplative moment there when we got to realize what these men might be up to. So that's what I wanted to say there anyway.
Well, certainly Franklin Roosevelt was a Freemason.
Yes, yeah.
That's well known. And a lot of his cabinet were Freemasons because Freemasonry, you know, in those days was really at its pinnacle in American society anyway. You know, it reached its peak, I think, in the immediate post-war years up until about the mid-50s, and it's been declining in membership ever since. It's lost several million members since, you know, the early 1950s. And his successor, Harry Truman, was Grand Master of Masons of Michigan. So certainly, you know, Freemasons occupied positions of power. You know, and you can make out a conspiratorial scenario, although I'm more inclined to think that a lot of these guys were, you know, because in those, you go back in those days, and Freemasonry was a, you know, it was an organization that could serve one's secular ambitions, simply because you went into it and you had a network that you immediately became a part of. You know, many prominent men in the early 20th century were Freemasons. So somebody who is ambitious, you know, in the worldly sense, could certainly see that as a stepping stone to the fulfillment of their ambitions without having any interest really in the spiritual side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that played a big role in it. But, you know, when you get into the conspiratorial aspect, I've used the analogy that, well, you know, if they were running things, you know, we haven't really seen a Masonic president since Gerald Ford.
That would be too obvious at this stage. That's why they don't do that. I don't know.
Well, you know, certainly in the George Bush administrations, I couldn't find anybody really up in the upper echelons who were Freemasons. Obama, I understand, did actually go through the Prince Hall Masonic, but I don't think he's ever been active.
Mm.
I think, again, he was probably more, well, you know, for a lot of these guys, well, it's the thing you do, you know. If your father did it or your grandfather did it or your uncle do it, you do it just to carry on the tradition. I've known many Masons who've done it just for that reason, and it really doesn't go any further than that.
Exactly. I'll reference that the clip or the program we do with Christopher Knight. I'll send it to you as well. We can listen to it and see what you think about it. And I'll leave it up as a related show so that people are listening can listen to that and get their own take on this and see what they think about it. And because I do also want to move on towards some of the sacred geometry aspects here, Randall, if you don't mind. We're going to take here in a little while, of course. We've been going for an hour, and it's really interesting, and I don't mean to cut it off in any way, but let's take a break here and carry on then in the next segment. We'll continue to talk more about this. And of course, as always, we want to give out websites. We want to let people know where to get the DVD and everything. It was released back in on the 21st of December, the Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe DVD. And of course, as we referenced last time, the website for that, where people can go, is sacredgeometryinternational.com. And then, Randall, you have your own research website for the cosmographicresearch.org, right? That's the website.
Yes, based on the word cosmography.
Cosmographicresearch.org. And of course, there's other ways to connect with the Sacred Geometry International Group. We'll have some links up to Facebook and Twitter, etc. as well. Anything else, by the way, you want to give out or anything you're going to... Are you doing some talks or anything like that now in the next couple of months?
I'm scheduled to do something called the Free Your Mind Conference up in Pennsylvania in April.
We know about that, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I saw that I was on the docket. Somewhere along the line, somebody said, "You want to do this?" And I said, "Well, I'll see if my schedule allows it." And then
you ended
somebody
up there.
Sent me a link, and there I was.
So that's funny.
By default, I guess.
Yeah, no, but that's good. For your mind conference in April, we might be there as well. We'll see if we can make it. So.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's cool. Any other websites or anything like that you want to give out now before we end the first segment here?
Well, now, my building website, archetypebuilders.com, archetype, archetype, has got some examples of some of my building work on it. I don't know if people would be interested in seeing that. There's a variety of different structures and things that that are on there. And cool. It's shortly going to be updated with, I think it's, you know, I don't think we've had an update on it in about 5 years, but there's some good stuff on there that people can see that, you know, I actually do go out and build things for a living.
Excellent. Really good. Yeah. We'll link all these up as well, Randall, so people can click through, you see, from our website. And yeah, we're going to carry on and continue our very interesting conversation here in a little bit. So thank you, Randall, for the first segment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.